for the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
Extra money is a good start because it does actually acknowledge that extra work that GPs need to undertake in visiting patients within the residential care setting.
That was Heidi Welbury from the Centre for Big Data Research in Health at the University of New South Wales. Heidi and her co-authors have done some research that shows that when people with dementia enter residential aged care, more likely than not, they will change GPs. Not only that, but that change in GP is associated with an uptick in prescribing, including an increase in the prescription of psychotropics. As we know, the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety found that the use of psychotropics for chemical restraint of patients was happening too much and recommended that it be used only as a second or third line treatment for difficult behaviours in patients with dementia. Heidi and her co-authors suggest that helping to smooth the transition into residential aged care may be one way of giving GPs alternatives to prescribing antipsychotics. Joining Heidi as my guest today is one of her co-authors, Scientia Professor Henry Bradati, who is Director of the Dementia Collaborative Research Centre and Co-Director of the Centre for Healthy Brain Ageing at the University of New South Wales. Your research sort of pinpointed that 72% of people with dementia who are going into aged care facilities change their general practitioner. Do we know why and what are the barriers to continuity of care in that situation?
Well, look, I think there are various reasons why continuity of care with someone's usual GP can be disrupted when they enter residential aged care facilities. So sometimes a person may move to a new geographic area when they enter residential care, for example, to be closer to another family member, a daughter, a son, so on. So obviously that will necessitate a change in GP to someone closer by. However, even when the residential care facility is close by, a GP can decide, or they may decide it's not possible to continue care. And it's not always practical or efficient for a GP to visit lots of different patients distributed across multiple different residential care facilities. Aside from the fact that's extra travel time for them, there's also, we know, administrative and logistical barriers when visiting such facilities, such as the extra time needed to find the right staff member to talk to, or not being able to access records in a timely manner. So just visiting one or two patients can actually be quite time intensive. What that means is that financially, it's often not comparable with seeing a patient in a clinic. So there's a lot of non-contact time spent in a visit. So that's something that they don't tend to get paid for.
Henry, what are the pros and cons of giving antipsychotics to people with dementia? Why do we do it and when is it appropriate to do it?
Antipsychotics are prescribed for about 20% of people in nursing homes, mainly people with dementia. They're usually prescribed for things like agitation or aggression, sometimes for wandering or roaming behaviour for which it's not indicated and is not effective, sometimes for calling out or screaming, and it doesn't work for that either. So generally, we advise not to prescribe antipsychotics because they're associated with side effects. The most worrying one is there's increased risk of death. It's about a 1% increase in risk, but also an increased risk of stroke. These are not that common, but of course, they're much more severe. Also, people can get the usual side effects of antipsychotics, such as a decrease in movement, looking a bit like someone with Parkinson's, a slowing of movement, less emotion in the faces. And they may also have an increased risk of falls, and there may be a sedation associated with it. So generally what we say is if people do have agitation or aggression, what's the cause? Understand the person, not just treat the behaviour. And usually non-pharmacological strategies can help. But if a pharmacological strategy is needed, then it's a second or third line treatment. And it's best to try and avoid antipsychotics of all the medications because they're the ones that are associated with these more serious side effects.
So it's only really appropriate as a last resort in some ways, yes?
Yes, well, yes, it's certainly not a first line resort. It's down the track. Occasionally, things are so dire or so desperate, if somebody is really aggressive and dangerous to others, you might try things simultaneously and then try and withdraw the antipsychotics. But it needs to be given with informed consent. And usually the residents in nursing homes with dementia are not able to give informed consent, in which case it needs proxy consent. And each state has different rules. In South Wales, that has to be given in writing. It's the responsibility of the prescriber to ensure that occurs. We did a survey of some nursing homes and looked at people who'd been started on antipsychotics who didn't have cognitive capacity to give consent. And we found that 1 in 13, 6.5%, had written consent from their proxy, and another 6.5% had verbal consent recorded in the notes. That means 87% had no consent of all residents started on antipsychotic had not been given informed consent by a proxy. I think the situation is even worse in hospitals, where it may be 0% who get that consent. The Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety made recommendations against the use of chemical restraints. And as a result of that, the Commonwealth Department of Health instigated a Aged Care Advisory Committee, on which I sit, which then looked at ways to safeguard against this happening. So a number of things have happened. One is it limits the use of antipsychotics under the PBS anyway for 12 weeks, and then repeat prescriptions and authority need to be obtained. There was a recommendation that only psychogeriatricians or geriatricians be allowed to approve the use of an antipsychotic, but there are workforce issues with that may not make that possible. But there is certainly a move, both the Commonwealth and state levels, to try and reduce the use of antipsychotics in nursing homes. My own experience, we did a study looking at de-prescribing antipsychotics in nursing homes. This is, and we were able to get 85% of people off their antipsychotics. And at 12 months, 75% still off the antipsychotics by educating their GP and the nurses and the family. So it's possible. One nursing home I went to had 90% of their residents on an antipsychotic. Others have down to 5%. So there's huge variability.
Heidi, tell us a little bit about why you decided to study this association with GP change and how you went about designing the study.
The background to this study is other work that's been done recently that has really shown the high level of antipsychotic use in nursing homes, and also shown that actually the biggest increase occurs just after entry to a residential aged care facility. So we were really interested in this transition point when somebody enters a residential aged care facility. In terms of this current study, it was a data linkage study based on the 45 and up study, which is a very large cohort in New South Wales running since 2006. But we were able to look at, within this larger study, just over 2,200 people who had dementia and had entered permanent residential aged care, and then also link their survey data to aged care records and also importantly to their pharmaceutical claims and Medicare claims. That meant we were able to look at the period just before entry to residential care and the period just after entry and look at the different GPs they had been seeing through the Medicare claims data. And we were able to classify people into one of three groups. So that included people who remained with their usual GP, so the person they were seeing most frequently before and after, it was the same GP. And then also people who changed their GP, we looked at a group who changed to a completely new provider that they had not seen prior to entry. And then there was also a group who changed to a GP who was not their usual GP prior to entry, but was a GP they had seen before. And then we were able to look at, within those three groups, their medicine dispensing patterns. So when they were claiming for different medicines, we were able to see all those claims and look at the different patterns before and after entry. So I guess we chose this study design because it allowed us to look at a fairly large group of residents with dementia without having to collect any extra data or burden them or their families with any extra surveys or questionnaires, but very importantly, it also allowed us to look at objective records of GP visits and medicine use.
And what were your big findings?
Firstly, we found that most people in the study changed GP after entry to residential aged care, so it was about 3 in 4. 44% to a new GP that they'd never seen before, and a further 29% to a GP that they had seen before but wasn't their usual GP prior to entry. And there was associations with changing to a new GP and having a larger increase in the number of medicines that were being used after entry to residential aged care. So this then meant that those in the new GP group were also more likely to be classified as having polypharmacy or even hyperpolypharmacy. So that's greater than or equal to 5 medicines at the same time, or in the case of hyperpolypharmacy, greater than or equal to 10 medicines. And then also within the new GP group, we observed an increase in the initiation of medicines like antipsychotics and benzodiazepines just after entry to residential aged care.
I'm chatting today with Heidi Welbury and Henry Prodati about the transition from the community into residential aged care for people with dementia. Their research is available at mja.com.au, where it is free to access. The latest issue of the MJA is now available online. It includes 5 papers on COVID-19, including a perspective on whether the upcoming Tokyo Olympics can be a COVID-safe event. Just as all our research is free to access, all our COVID-19 content is also free, regardless of article type. Other topics in this issue include research on non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, hospital admissions for cardiovascular disease, and the impact of pre-surgery hospital transfer on 30-day mortality after hip fracture. In short, it's a packed issue, and you can find it all at mja.com.au/journal/2021/215/2. Back to our chat with Heidi and Henry. I can imagine that somebody moves into aged care because of a crisis. How were you able to separate the prescribing of antipsychotics between those who'd had a crisis and needed antipsychotics and those who had just changed GP?
That's a great question. So we were able to also link to hospitalisation records, for example. So one of the really important tests that we did was actually look at people who'd had an emergency hospitalisation just prior to entry to residential aged care and those that hadn't. And actually, even though that was an important predictor of antipsychotic dispensing, was having a crisis like an emergency hospitalisation, we actually found this relationship with a new GP was the same in both groups, whether or not they'd had a hospitalisation prior or not. So the other thing is we were able to control for a whole lot of other factors that were available to us about the residents. So we were reasonably confident that we had managed to balance out those other confounding factors across the different GP groups.
Is it possible that moving into a facility triggers behaviour that requires antipsychotics or not requires but makes a GP think this might help?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I might ask Henry to expand a bit more on that in terms of the behaviours demonstrated at that entry point, but I think moving into a new environment could certainly trigger that. Potentially the fact that a new GP may be an unfamiliar person could actually add to that, the stress of a new situation as well.
Henry, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Heidi on that. But imagine if you're an 80-year-old person, you're confused, you're disorientated, you moved into an unfamiliar environment, you don't know the people, the environment seems strange, the routine is foreign to you, and you don't feel you have any control over what's happening. It's quite understandable such a person might get agitated, anxious, even lash out. And so agitation is a frequent symptom that occurs when people do move into a nursing home. And when it's an emergency, then there's no time for preparation. Where there's a planned process and the person's informed and they have done frequent visits to the nursing home previously, that may smooth the way. Or some nursing homes may have engineered a buddy system where somebody, one of the other residents, might buddy up with them and try and relieve that. It used to be in hospitals when children were admitted to children's wards, staff would say to the parents, I don't come, it'll just upset them, because every time the parents left, the child would cry. And it resulted in children develop what was called anaclitic depression. They just withdrew and cut off completely. And unfortunately, I still see some nursing homes who tell families, wait till they settle in before you come and visit them. It's a very fraught decision. It's the families are often guilty. The person with the new resident doesn't want to be there and feels betrayed. There may be anger, recriminations, and all that disorientation and strangeness that I mentioned before can all precipitate behaviours which are difficult to handle. So, you know, one way of handling them is to sedate them, but that really should not be the first resort.
How do we smooth out that process so that we don't end up at antipsychotic prescription?
There's a few practical ways that may help. So acknowledging that it's actually a very difficult situation, and obviously there's perhaps no ideal way of smoothing out this process. But, I mean, one practical thing is actually supporting patient handover through improving access to, say, single electronic medical records across different settings. So it certainly doesn't help if a new GP is taking on a patient they haven't seen before and can't access all of their medical history and can't see their full medication history, and doesn't necessarily know what has already been tried before with a particular patient. So certainly there are technological ways of supporting that process, and I know the Royal Commission has recommended the use of, they've called it digital care management systems that includes electronic medication management and is interoperable with things like My Health Record. So that's one practical way of supporting a new GP in this situation. But I think other ways that support could be provided through encouraging things like multidisciplinary care planning when a new resident enters a care home. Also, better utilising other support structures already exist, such as medication management reviews, which allows other experts like pharmacists to really look at things like the medication and provide recommendations that would be aimed at increasing the safe use of medicines. So there are various, different ways that GPs could be supported in this situation.
How can the government help this? I mean, we've talked earlier about the lack of financial incentives for GPs working in aged care. How do we encourage governments to make life better for GPs who want to work in aged care facilities?
The Australian government has just recently announced new incentives for GPs to provide care to patients in residential care. So this is via the practice incentive payments scheme that exists for GPs. And basically, it could amount to an extra $10,000 per year for a GP, depending on the number of services that they provide to patients in residential care. So they've proposed a four-tier payment system based on the number of services provided. So, look, extra money is a good start, because it does actually acknowledge that extra work that GPs need to undertake in visiting patients within the residential care setting. Whether or not it's going to encourage more GPs to provide care will remain to be seen. I mean, it hopefully will reduce some of the financial pressures GPs are currently facing, though, in providing that kind of care.
You also talked about GPs specialising in aged care and getting accredited for aged care. What are the pros and cons of that?
So again, these are some recommendations that are came out of the Aged Care Royal Commission recently, that an accreditation process could be considered for GP practices to specialise or focus on providing care in an aged care setting. So look, I think there's a lot of merit behind this kind of approach in terms of supporting GPs to provide services and also potentially increasing quality of care. The potential issue that we can see in terms of the findings of our current study are that subspecialisation of GPs in aged care may actually reduce or concentrate the number of GPs who are providing this care, which may actually increase the likelihood that a person will have to change GPs on entering care, because they will need to change to a GP who is providing that care. So given our findings around this transition point, I guess it's just something to for people to bear in mind when they're having this discussion around what highest quality model of care might be for providing primary care in this setting.
Henry, if I made you king for a day, wave your magic wand, what would you like to see happen right away to improve things for patients in this situation?
Several things, Kate. First of all, regarding GPs, it's under the aged care legislation, everyone's entitled to have their GP when they move into a residential care setting, and that's understandable. But it may be that the nursing home has 60 residents and 60 GPs, theoretically. And so it's very difficult to have a coordinated policy and agreement on procedures to be done. In some countries, such as the Netherlands, they do have subspecialization for doctors, and they spend, it's a two-year training course, and become like geriatric GPs. And they do an excellent job. So even though the person will be changing GPs, to have specialised GPs interested in aged care would make a big difference. So the rebate system doesn't encourage any depth in trying to understand the behaviours for GPs. Yeah. And as Heidi has pointed out, the inefficiencies for general practitioners in seeing individual patients militate against them actually going. I would do the following. And we showed this in our, what's called the HALT study, which was a deep prescribing antipsychotics in nursing homes. I would arrange that every nursing home would have champion nurses, and the champions would have training in how to train the other nurses. It's train the trainer model. And if it's a big nursing home, you'd have more than one champion. And they would get some extra funding for taking on that role. And they would be doing on-the-spot training at handovers based on actual cases about how to manage and how to help the people live well in the care facility. And many people have a very positive quality of life in nursing homes. And we always think about the worst parts of nursing homes, but there are many nursing homes that are very creative, very supportive, very loving in the way they provide their care. I would also have some continuity of general practice, and it may be a change at the time of moving into the nursing home, but somebody who's got an interest in continuing care. And also, if you have several patients in the home, then it doesn't become so inefficient from a cost point of view for the practitioner. I think the rules about limiting the use of psychotropics in general, particularly antipsychotics and benzodiazepines, are good, and they should be enforced. And if people do have side effects, then the families should be making some protest about that. I think a lot has to do with the families themselves, and they need to take some responsibility. In the same way the family would be advocating for their child in hospital, families need to be informed about what's happening to their loved one. They need to be involved, and they need to be the advocates for the person. They need to look at the medications. They need to be insisting that they do provide the consent as required. So it's a combination of top-down with regulation, proper subsidization and compensation for time spent, with training and, as we know from the Royal Commission, adequate staffing as well as bottom-up from public attitudes and families taking some responsibility.
What about you, Heidi? Wave your magic wand for me. What would you do?
I think GPs need to be paid more in general, but yes. Particularly in this instance, paid appropriately for the amount of time and effort to provide really high quality care to residents, because I think this is particularly at this transition point is the time where they really need somebody to invest that time to then start the process of that transitioning into a good high quality care relationship throughout the time they spend in a nursing home. I think certainly some of the initiatives that hopefully will come out of the Royal Commission recommendations are a good start. Encouraging medication reviews and ongoing review of medication going to be beneficial. Also, I think, really trying to encourage more multidisciplinary care in a way that, is accessible by everyone, because I think sometimes this can happen really well, but it probably doesn't happen across the board. And possibly it happens for people with those advocates that really pushing and trying to promote this kind of high quality care. But for the people who don't have advocates, it may not be occurring at all.
Heidi mentioned about multidisciplinary care. Allied health have a huge role to play in nursing homes. Most nursing homes have very little in the way of allied health. Very few clinical psychologists go into nursing homes. There are a group who are now becoming stronger. of psychologists interested in this area, occupational therapists and social workers working with the families. There are some nursing homes that do provide these, most don't. So that's really important as well. As well as physical exercise, you know, the physiotherapist has a role, and having good programs, a good diversional therapist can make a huge difference to how a nursing home works.
Thank you both for your time. My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.